And welcome back to Dads on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, and men's and boys' issues. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our guest today is William McInnes. William is the author of Fatherhood, Stories About Being a Dad, and he is one of Australia's most popular writers and actors. His new book, Fatherhood, Stories About Being a Dad, joins other best-selling memoirs, A Man's Got to Have a Hobby, and That'd Be Right. And he's, of course, a well-known actor in series such as Sea Change. I should also mention that in 2009, as part of the Q150 celebrations, William was announced as one of 150 icons as an influential artist, along with the Nambour pineapple. So, William, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Along with a Nambour big pineapple, there you go. The poor old big cow didn't get a mention.
Well, you know you've made it, don't you, when you put it in the same bracket as that.
Big pineapple. I always thought I was a vegetable, but I'm a big fruit. Never mind.
Well, William, you say up front that your book is not a manual of how to be a better father. So if it's not that, how would you describe it?
Well, I wouldn't put my hand up as a life advice person at all. I may be in the same bracket as a big pineapple, but my head's not that big. And I, honestly, a bit of trouble with lifestyle gurus. I think being a father's not everyone's bag, and that's okay. I mean, there are some people that just doesn't happen for them. But there's a commonality to being a father. I think it is a shared experience. And, you know, hearing stories about that, even if it's not your experience, it's always great to have a lot of information about something. Sharing stories is a method by you do that. It's a big responsibility being a father. I mean, it's not just some old coot who you think's a bit cranky and cantankerous and it's fun to get a rise out of. Being a father is you're introducing to your children their first grown-up male. Now, whether you like that or not, that's what's happening. And they will absorb what you do, not just your words but your actions, how you conduct yourself. And when you think about that, it does my big pineapple head in sometimes, because quite frankly, it's a bit of a responsibility. But it's always best to err on the side of humour and enjoying the experience more than wagging a finger and telling readers or people that this is a lesson you're going to have to learn.
Well, you mention your father quite frequently in this book, and I like the advice that he gave. He was prepared to give some advice, and I wonder if you could just explain that to us a bit about the... I like the bit about have a crack, but leave a little space for others.
Yeah, he was always wanting people to get on. He was aspirational in the sense that he wanted to get on and provide for his family, for himself, to provide a better future for his kids. He wanted to impart to us that it was really important to get on and have a crack. That was his big thing, just get out there and have a crack. And if you get on, keep on going, but make sure you leave a little bit of space so other people can have a crack. He said cut them a bit of slack, because if you share opportunity around, everyone benefits. And that's pretty old school Jesuit, I guess, that sort of character advice, but it's just an old school way of looking at life that I have tried to live by and think we've all tried to live by. And, you know, I've seen some things my kids have done which have made me so proud, and I think you're doing what your grandfather tried to do. You know, you're trying to just leave a bit of space for people to get on and get up and have a go. And I think it's a pretty good template by which to live. You know, everyone's aspirational these days, or many of us. And, you know, we've had the recently departed Prime Minister saying that aspiration was good, and I think it's good. But aspiration for aspiration's sake is pointless, because you just aspire for yourself and no one else. And being a father, the whole thing is to aspire basically for your children, because when you have children, it's not about you anymore. Your leading man days in your own movie are over. You know, you've got little sprogs to look out for. And, I mean, I'm just an old conservative sentimentalist, but I think having kids is fantastic. It's something that was really my bag, and I've adored it.
you talk at some stages about how you feel like you're turning into your father a little bit. It sounds like your children are turning into their grandfather a little bit.
A little bit. I mean, that's what's so nice when you share things with your kids about you. You know, I was very young when my old man was born. I mean, I was very young. You can tell me. That statement is a product of the Queensland education system of the 70s. I was very young when I was born. I was the youngest of his kids, so he was about 43. So he was quite an old father. He had four other kidlets to be looking after. And there's a lot about my dad I don't know. I didn't know what he did before that. But the impact he made on me was pretty big. And as I get older, I think back, and I just hope he knew how much I loved him. You know, sometimes it's just your nature as a young person growing up, that you sort of grow away from your parents a bit, and that's what's supposed to happen. And maybe they're expecting to hear things, or maybe they're not. But it would have been nice, especially on Father's Day, I mean, even though it's a commercial enterprise, just I hope one of those awful presents I gave him, he actually knew or heard me say I love him, because I think it's very important. He's a different man to me. I mean, he lived through a depression and a world war and the uncertainties of the post-Second World War world, you know, through the upheaval of the 60s and the 70s, rampant consumerism of the 80s. But he never, ever lost that sense of generosity that his generation had. That's why I think that life of his extends beyond his own and mine into my kids, because that sort of person's worthwhile to pass on to your children. And it's done in sort of really dopey ways too. I remember going to have lunch with my daughter not so long ago, and I just walked up behind her. I was going to give her a little bit of a fright in the cafe we were meeting at, and she was doing a bit of work on a laptop, and she was humming a Dean Martin song. Now, if you could tell me a 20-year-old that is humming in the chapel in the moonlight, in a hipster cafe, I don't think you'd be able to get too many fingers raised in accounting. So that's sort of nice that they behave in a way, perhaps, that's been guided by my old man.
And yet children sometimes don't perceive their dads in the way that we think they might perceive them. Some examples you give are where the father is perceived as vampires and pirates and...
that's an opening. That's a bit of news. You know, you had... the guy's a dentist. When my son was very small and just, I think... not prep, but maybe year one or two, there was a thing where you drew your father as something, as a cartoon character, if you like, and there was a lot of Mufasas going around, which is interesting, isn't it? Like, that idea of what a father is, and kids appropriating Mufasa, the noble jungle king. It's weird how these things just sit in the psyche of people.
I think that was your ambition to be Mufasa, wasn't it?
But I got... The one guy was... a vampire, which was fantastic. I hope I get Mufasa. There was a couple of Darth Vaders, which I said, you don't want to go there. But, he had a problematic relationship with his kids, didn't he, really? You know? But anyway, it all ended well. I thought, well, who will I get? And this teacher said, oh, it'll be interesting to see how you react. I thought, oh, what is it? And he'd coloured in a trace thing of foghorn leghorn, you know, the big... a big garrulous southern rooster from the Looney Tunes. And he just went, you know, you're the big chook, you're the funny rooster. I was thinking, what? And my daughter just was cuddling me going, chooky, big chooky, big chooky. And it was. I've still got it up the back of my study. It's one of those things that is so sweet. You know, I know Father's Day is a bit of a reason to flog stuff, but I spoke to a mate about it and he said, I love it. And I said, yeah, what you get? And he said, burnt toast, coffee the way I don't like, and hugs that'll last me forever. And I thought, man, that's what it is. It's just a chance, even though it's a commercial exercise, it's just a chance to share a bit of love and affection if you're lucky enough to have a father, and a father that you can tell, and maybe you can remember your old man. And, you know, as I said before, I'm not going to say to you, Bill, that's the way it should be. I mean, some people have problematical relationships with fathers, and some never had one, so... It's a bit of a funny hand life can deal you sometimes.
Well, you had a bit of a checkered career with Father's Day and some of the presents you gave to your father, but I like the story of the last appearance of the cheese board that you'd managed to make for him.
Yeah, he was a builder. But he was sort of what you'd call a man's man, you know. He was one of those fellows that were running around building things, working with his hands. He loved manual work. And he was a house builder. And then I would bring home these dreadful pieces of lamentable metalwork. And, you know, when you're a kid, entering adolescence, really, and the go-to subject at high school, junior high school, was called manual training, manual arts, which wasn't like art. It was deeply practical, and the highest praise you wanted was one of these hairy, bilious, bull-necked manual arts training teachers was to hold up whatever you'd made and say, "This is a hand-built utensil." That was all I ever. I never got it, and you know. I was in the worst class where we would cannibalise each other's work to try and get a perfect scone cutter. I made a strainer that my mother said that was wonderful, and when she tried to use it, she nearly schooled herself. A scone cutter that was just too awful beyond words, that caused all sorts of trouble. And I made a cheese board. Now, how you bugger up a cheese board, I don't know. But it was just a bit of particle board with Formica glued on top and a handle. And it was like, seriously, it was so inept. That it was like a novelty from an Ecker show bag. And I took it home and, oh man, look, this, oh, that's something. And he patted me on the head, thanks, mate. And he went on his way and I forgot about it. You know, and I thought, I'm just going to fall into disrepair and up in the bin. And after he died, my mum, as it happens, parcels up bits and pieces that are left at someone's life. And she thought, well, I'll give these to each of the kids. And at the bottom of my box was the cheese board he'd kept it, which was even if he'd just forgotten about it, he'd kept it. And that was something quite sweet. I mean, as I said, he was a loud, volcanic personality. But as I think about it, that was such a sweet thing to have done. There was a time when I really wanted to be good at that subject, and I was lousy at it. And I didn't feel great about that, but he kept it. And I just sat there holding it, wobbling the handle, thinking, you were a sweet man. You were a very sweet, kind man.
In your own case, you think it's important to explain to the kids how that you met their mother, and you talk about how you met her at Bronte, and you talk about drinks in North Bondi. But how difficult was it to raise those two kids? As you, in the end, you've had to raise a lot of them on your own.
Well, Clem was finishing off high school when Sarah, my wife, died, and Stella was just entering it, really. So I didn't really raise them on my own. I mean, I tell you what I did realise, Bill, how much work had been done by her. Mm. And in a way, I was thinking how little I did when I was trying to do both. And I think a lot of men who aren't single parents will realise that. You think, man, maybe somebody else has been doing all the hard yards. But they've turned out fairly well, I think. You know, you can't really know too much about life, but I know they love their mum very deeply, and how they've managed without her, that's their story. But it was, it's nice. I just told them how we met at, you know, Bondi, North Bondi RSL, which has got a beautiful, it was funny in the book, it was a funny day. I just was there, and it just, when you're in a particular mood, you just see other fathers in action, you know, there were whole, just a brief visions or scenes from someone's life, and I just thought, there's such a lot of backstory behind what I'm just witnessing here between these fathers and their children. I told them about it, and then when they're in Sydney, they just sent a text saying, oh, I'm just on the veranda of the place where you and Mum met, which they've got a little bit arse about. I didn't meet her at the RSL, but it's still quite nice. It's still quite lovely. Thing that, you know, it's a place where they can go and think, well, this is a part of my parents' stories. And really, that's all the book's really about. It's just a buffhead celebration to the idea of fatherhood, really. And, you know, and if it can prompt anyone to think about their old man and how they father, then that's great. I mean, it is funny. I mean, I think my favourite thing in that book is the father threats, you know. Father threats, I mean, they sound terrible, but they're not. And then from a more unreconstructed age when I was a kid, they were a hoot, you know. Some of them, you know, do I, you're going to make me get out of my chair?
it rises to a crescendo when, you know, do I have to, in the car, for instance, do I have to turn the engine off?
Yeah, the father's trying to sort of deal out justice and drive at the same time. They're out of said he was hopeless. He was going nowhere near it. He'd get more infuriated. And he kept on turning off the light. And then they would turn the light back on and he'd turn it off with a swish of the hand. I mean, it's very funny, but it, you know, could be quite dangerous. But they were never really, I think, you know, in an age when you do want people to be secure and happy and safe and surrounded by love. It was an introduction to the idea that, you know, sometimes the male grown-up in your life had other things going on his plate, and that sort of tipped over to that sort of behaviour, which is great that you can learn that as a kid. I don't know whether you learn it at the time, but certainly in hindsight, I think you realise that being a father is all sorts of things.
There must be a temptation to become something, as you describe it, as a hybrid parent, where you sort of step out of your role as a father and try and be all parents to all children, and that's probably not a good thing, I suppose.
Well, it's not a bad thing, but it's certainly not an efficient thing, because you can't be all things. You can't actually be both parents. You can try, and sometimes you can pull things off, but I think kids need a significant woman in their life, or a mother figure, if you want, and that can come in many ways. I mean, I know their aunts were really wonderful on both sides of the family, especially Sarah's family, and my sisters. They all sort of stepped up, you know, they just let them know that those kids were valued and loved, and my sister-in-law as well. Really, really just a testament to the decency and the compassion of people. And it wasn't like it was the Brady Bunch, you know. It wasn't like something like that, but it was just little things that those kids knew, I think, that they meant something to people. But again, you know, you can sort of, I think it's more fun just to sort of remember how things go a bit south and how you can over-worry on an issue with your kids, and you suddenly think they've got something worked out here. They're managing, and I'm sort of faffing around like a headless chook, and that's really reassuring. But sometimes, you know, sometimes there's nothing you can do to sort of stop someone grieving, and nor should you, because when you lose someone from your life, like a beloved mother and wife, partner, you've got to take time to feel life's rough edge, because if you don't, then you're not dealing with it. And I'm not saying we've dealt with it completely, and I'm not telling anyone how to deal with it, but I just know that you've got to go through pretty painful times.
Yeah, I would think the security that your children have been able to get, and that all children should have from the love that you've talked about so often, that lets them go forward. And I mean, at a lower level, you talk about how you you turned up somewhere with a haircut described as a Bundaberg waterfall. And I guess the security you'd already gained from your parents enabled you to sort of leap over that little problem.
Yeah. Isn't that a great name for a mullet? I've only heard that a few times, but I'd say, and it's not a slight against Bundaberg, but a Bundaberg waterfall. Or an ape drape. Ape drape, yeah, I had a mullet. I had a perm, and I had a really bad mullet. And my son, I don't know how he got through this year of school, high school, but he had a mullet, and he said it was a bet or something they were having, and the money went to some charity, or he said it did. And he'd actually given his mullet a name. It was Murray the Mullet. Yeah, very funny, very funny. And, you know, in a way, you've got to let your kids chart their own course too. So many parents probably know that it's going to end in some sort of tears or on the rocks, but it's their life after a while, and you can't stop them becoming a certain person or having a particular personality trait. I mean, you can try. Good luck to you. And I'm not speaking about bad things here, but they grow into their own person. And, of course, you're a part of that. But after a while, you've just got to let them go. So that can be pretty hard, too, because, you know, having kids is, you know, Bill, you've got to ask yourself, most people would say, I just want to be safe. Well, that's not living, really. What does safe mean? You can't just cherry-pick the ages of your child, because if you just wanted them to stay, say, 4 or 5, then you wouldn't get the benefits of all their other experiences that they've had as they grow. That's pretty hard. That's a parent's. Parents are going to feel that. That's life. I mean, my son. son used to be the most beautiful little boy. He'd run around in the backyard and you'd see, he'd just sit there having a cup of coffee and you'd see him cupping butterflies in his hands and he'd be giggling and then he'd just hold his hands above his head and let the butterfly fly out. And I thought, what a beautiful little boy. And then he turns into this Clydesdale who's got a mullet called Murray. I mean, how does that work? But in a way, I quite like Clem who had Murray the mullet. I thought, I couldn't have got away with that at his age. But good luck to the lad.
And sometimes it does go, appears to go a bit awry. You talk about a friend of yours, I think, the Lone Wolf. And I thought that was a wonderful story with a good song in it.
He was a rat bag, he was an eccentric, but he was such a lovely man, really compassionate and nice man. He's an older bloke who I met at drama school, and there was a gang of us who just thought he was the bee's knees. But he sort of had a bit of a problematic relationship with his old man, and he didn't really ever make, he didn't really sort of come to terms with, they didn't come to terms with each other, but he always said his old man was a big corporate dude. And he just said, I was leaving school one day, drama school, and he was going off. I said, "Oh, Lone Wolf, where are you off to?" And he said, "My father's dying. I'm just going to see him. Would you come?" And I thought, "Oh, sure." And I thought, that's a pretty odd thing, but yeah, okay. And we went to an aged care facility, and this man wasn't in the hospital, but he was very old, I could see, and not well. And this pal of mine was just sitting there, and he turned to me. He said, "You know, he always used to say, 'Good luck in the race, the human race,' like it was some. And I always thought it was like some competition. But he was thinking when he was thinking about his dad, that his dad said, 'Good luck in the human race, good luck in the race, the human race. It's the only race we've got. Take care.' And he said, I didn't listen to that. I had these ideas about my father that maybe were true, but maybe weren't, but I forgot that take care out there, it's the only race we've got. You know, being a human is all we've got." That's what he was saying. And then he said this guy was this big corporate dude, and he always sort of sing La Mer, an old Charles Trey song, the French song. And he said, "You know, I was just listening to it this morning, and you know, the Bobby Darin had a song called Beyond the Sea, and this guy said, that was crap, they were crap lyrics. The English translation of the song is so beautiful. It's just about a man journeying home, and he sees this beautiful, this moment of beauty, and that's what the song's about." And I was looking at this mad, generous rat bag of a friend, and he said, "It's just like life." And he sang it, and on his silly ukulele, and it, you know, I doubt it was just beautiful because it was. I sort of thought this is him saying to his dad, "Whatever's gone on between us, I love you, and I sort of get a bit of you that maybe I didn't before." And I was pretty sort of sweet and privileged, actually, in a way. I mean, Jesus, I'm telling so much about the book, they won't buy it, Bill.
Well, no, there's plenty more, but it's I love it. So I think that's a great introduction. Let's listen to Charles Trenet singing La Mer.
Beautiful.
La Mer, qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs, a des reflets d'argent. La mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges. Des purs, la mer, bergère d'azur, infinie. Voyez, près des étangs, ces grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez, des oiseaux blancs et ces maison rouillée. La mer les a bercés le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour, la mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie, la mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent, la mer des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer au ciel d'été confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs. La mer bergère d'azur infinie. Voyez près des étangs des grands roseaux mouillés. Voyez ces oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées. La mer les a bercés le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour là-bas a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.
And that was La Mer by Charles Tenet. And we're speaking today with William McInnes, the author of a new book, Fatherhood, Stories About Being a Dad. And I don't need to remind people that William is one of Australia's favourite storytellers. William, unfortunately, we've reached the end of the program, so it just remains for me to thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air. Well, let's hope so. Don't forget, we'd love to hear from any of our listeners. You can go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and send us an email, and we'll be in touch. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, dadsontheair.com.au, and you can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. And we'll be back next week with another show on Dad's on the Air.